Tommy Robinson has called a Brexit betrayal march in London. Backed by North American money and with nearly a million followers on Facebook alone, Robinson has become an icon of this dangerous far-right insurgency. How do we analyse this new movement? What lessons should we draw from the past, and how does Brexit fit in? These are some of the questions we'll be discussing in today's podcast, with me, Luke Cooper, in Vienna, and my guests over in London. We're joined by Asad Rehman, who works in the NGO sector, but is here in a personal capacity. He's very involved in the Stop Trump coalition, and is just generally a seasoned campaigner in numerous anti-racist struggles down the years. We've also pulled in Alina Ivanova and Michael Chesham from the Another Europe office. To feed back to us on today's podcast, find us on Twitter on @another_Europe, or look us up on Facebook at facebook.com/AnotherEurope is possible. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming on the show. So, Asad, let's start with you. Tell us about some of the first anti-fascist activity you ever did. How do you think the fascism of that time compares to today?
Well, as you might be able to tell from my accent, I grew up in Lancashire in a small town called Burnley, which was, I suppose, an experience shared by many young Asian and young black people during that time of intense racist violence. In my school, the National Front used to sell the bulldog. As a community, we were under siege, people being attacked on the way to school, in our communities, the far right very active around the local football club. And so a lot of our first organising, again, anti-fascism, was around racist violence and exposing the lack of action by the authorities, by the schools and by the police, and organising ourselves. We formed the Asian Youth Movement, led a school strike, defended our community and recognised what the far right was doing. And of course, this was a time when the National Front was marching in their tens of thousands up and down the country, besieging black communities, and the black community was defending itself and forming its own radical anti-racist black organisations, the Asian Youth Movement's been just one of them. And I subsequently then moved to East London, to Newham, and was involved with the Newham Monitoring Project, which was a community-based anti-racist organisation that worked around racial violence and police violence. And East London was one of the areas where the far right was extremely strong. It had polled about a third of all the votes in Canning Town. We were very central to driving the far right out of East London. No platform of tackling them ideologically, politically, but also physically, preventing them from organising, preventing them from having a toehold in our communities, and trying to break the far right from its soft underbelly. And of course, that was, you know, very much the strategy through the 80s and 90s. And for the black communities, I mean, I think one of the very important things to say is, of course, people at this moment talk a little bit and say, oh, well, you know, are we going back to the 1970s? And I think, you know, the reality for black communities in the 1980s and black self-organisation was the importance of not only tackling fascism, but also tackling racism. And that had been a major debate. And of course, the Anti-Nazi League was very, very active. Its slogan, the National Front is a Nazi Front, was effective. But from black organisations, we were pointing out that racist murders were on the huge increase. Racist violence was one of the most common experiences for most communities, that actually, if we wanted to seriously tackle fascism, we had to tackle racism.
I know you must get asked this quite a lot, just because you've been involved for such a long time. But, you know, do you think the kind of racism that you were confronting then, I mean, what's the progress, basically?
I don't think it's a direct comparison, because, of course, in the 1970s, as communities, we were under siege, right? And physically, we were under siege from the far right and from racist violence. That pattern of racism and racist attacks hasn't gone away. But as a community, we're talking now much more about normalised racism, about Islamophobia being the main frame, about the media normalising, politicians normalising it. It has become, I think, much more acceptable. It's passing the dinner party test, where in the 1970s, amongst large sections of society, it would, racism and fascism would not pass the dinner party test, irrespective of what people's maybe personal view may be. I think now people feel it's absolutely legitimate to talk about migrants, talk about refugees, to talk about Muslims in a way that I don't think we've felt, I would say, probably since the 60s in terms of the narrative and the language. And so I think it's a very, very different experience. In terms of the fear in our communities, I suppose, you know, we have to talk very much about that our different communities have different experiences. It's a very, very different experience if you're living in London in strong black communities than if you're living in a small northern town. Right. That is absolutely, and it's a very, very different experience if you are a migrant or a refugee than a settled black community. And of course, one of the changes of racism we've seen is this framing that we're not against all black people, we're just against some black people. We're not racist, we just have a problem with the Muslims or with Islam. I think that frame is what makes it very, very different from what we were seeing in the 1970s.
So let's bring in the others. We'll talk in a second about the Robinson demo, but I was wondering if you had any immediate comments on what Assad is saying about the new racism, particularly thinking about it in terms of your experience as an EU migrant.
Yeah, I mean, I think the situation currently with EU migrants is quite an interesting one because you can't really talk of a unified EU migrant community, can you? I think people have very different concepts of themselves and to what extent they would classify themselves as migrants even. And I think that's also reflected in some of the narratives that we mentioned. I think the negativity and prejudice against EU migrants is kind of coming from a slightly different angle. It's dehumanizing in a different way. It's all about economic value and people as units of economic contribution or social contribution. It very much plays on this deserving versus undeserving migrant narrative. And on the face of it, it's not racialized in the same way. But actually, if you scratch under the surface of what people are saying, and I think that's very obvious online, probably a lot more than in actual face-to-face conversations you have with people. But the jump that people make between talking about EU migration and Islamophobia and fear of some grand conspiracy for Muslims to take over Britain via somehow the vehicle of freedom of movement and EU migration is a really interesting one. One of our supporters organised a migrants welcome, a little rally in Sheffield, which was great. And I think we should be seeing a lot of that happening all over the country. But what I found fascinating and you know, repulsive as well, were some of the comments that this event attracted. And they were all basically framed around three ideas. We're full. It's fine for people to come here if they're going to contribute. And then the third one always came down to Muslims and Islamophobia. So the idea of migration, I think, and the resistance to migration is part of a much more complex and kind of over-encompassing concept that people have in their heads. It's not really about where you come from at the end of the day. It's just about this othering of people. So that's why I think it is really important for us as, you know, socialists, left-wing activists, to be tackling the narrative against migration without going into who contributes what and to what extent.
So, Michael, let's bring you in here. And maybe I want to direct you to talk about Tommy Robinson, real name Stephen Yaxley-Lennon. What do we think this new fascism really stands for? What's their end game?
It's a very big question. And I think partly this feeds into the broad theme of the changing nature of racism. And obviously, the nature of racism hasn't changed entirely. But I think this idea that what we've seen is the absorption of racist narratives into the mainstream of British politics. And I think to a great extent, the Brexit moment has played a huge role in mainstreaming those narratives and those ideas. to an extent, you know, far-right leaders claiming to be more respectable than their followers and claiming to make overtures to more establishment right-wing political figures is not necessarily unique to Yaxley Lennon. And people, yeah, I often think on both sides of the Brexit debate, I think we talk about Brexit in terms of the EU, we talk about Brexit in terms of European identity and of European free movement. Now, those are all legitimate discussions to have, but it is not uncommon to come across people, as Elena says, during the Brexit debate, who basically say, I'm voting for Brexit because there are too many Muslims in the country. And I think that tells you a great deal about the underlying project that is Brexit and the role that project is playing. On Sunday the 9th of December, we have, you know, a real-life confluence of Yaxley Lennon and the Brexit project, backed by UKIP, which is talking about their project in those terms. And I think we have to have, if we're going to oppose this new far right, at least a politics around Brexit, a politics around free movement. The left has been left unable, in a way, to deal with this moment because they want to start talking about this as if it was another fascist mobilisation, as if this moment was like any other far-right demonstration. It's largely a product of the fact that the left is divided and doesn't really know what to say about Brexit in this particular moment. You know, the vast majority of the left back remain. The vast majority of rank-and-file Labour members want a referendum on the deal with an option to remain and all that. But the left itself, especially in a way, the left that has found itself clustered around the Corbyn project, has found itself attached to the triangulation of that Corbyn project around the issue of Brexit. You know, Brexit is a real thing. We are not dealing with a concept here. We're dealing with, you know, a project whose practical and real outcome, 2 days after the far-right march on December the 9th, will be the end of free movement. I think you've got to deal with that. There's an attempt to raise different slogans around that within the protest. And obviously, you know, on December the 9th, we will all march together. We're mobilising people on an anti-Brexit basis and on a pro-free movement basis for a united anti-fascist mobilisation. Of course, we're not going to split the demonstration, but I think we've got to make the point. You know, if you're not in favour of defending free movement, you're not against Fortress Britain. Really, on a practical level, we're talking about the really existing expansion of border controls. And I think probably a lot of the reaction that we're getting, look, partly is that people disagree with our analysis and they don't think it's right to raise an anti-Brexit slogan in the context of Yaxley Lennon for tactical and strategic reasons. And, yeah, there's a discussion to be had about that, and I'll argue that point. But a lot of the really vitriolic stuff that we've got about calling this block, the left probably sees free movement disappearing. It sees the narrative that has made that happen, and I think we've pointed out quite a big hole, which I think raises moral problems for the left and the way that it's triangulated around the Brexit issue, trailing the Labour leadership.
Just a quick question for everyone. Did Yaxley Lennon just change his name to Tommy Robinson to sound less posh? Is that the reason?
I think there's a number of reasons. Of course, his reason is, I was doing it for security reasons, protect my family, etc. I'm sure part of it is to sound more authentic and working class. And of course, that's how the new leaders of the far right want to situate themselves.
Culturally, there's a grand old tradition, like this is how you build a folk hero. This is how you build like a Robin Hood type of a figure. You kind of create a persona that's larger than the individual. So it to me, it makes perfect sense. And it's not even just about sounding more working class or whatever. It's about having a grander narrative, you know, building a tale around it.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, him changing his name and us, you know, and the left taking some pleasure out to keep, I'd say, in Stephen Yaxley Lennon. To me, that's not the most important part, right? I mean, the key question here is, you know, the project that they have about building a new populist far-right movement in this country, how that connects to the populist movements we've seen across Europe. And it's part of a global trend that we're seeing, and how, you know, they use particular frames in that, you know. And opposition to immigration is a very, very central one. And this is one of the themes that I think connects all of the far-right movements, right? Not just at this moment, but going back to the 90s and 80s and 60s and beginning of the century, when Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts and others were opposing Jewish migration. We know that that has been one of the tropes on which they frame. And so, of course, Brexit has played into that. On the morning after the referendum, you know, my friend's daughter went to school, she's mixed race, and was told, you're going home, right? You're going to leave this country. And I think for many people in the Black community, that was the experience. The experience was there was a vote on the European Union, but its expression for so many people was a very racialized against all visible Black people. And so I think it is interesting in terms of that whilst the debate around Brexit has been about European migration, the intent actually is also about looking at the settled Black community and all migration, both existing and the fear of new migration, particularly Muslim migration. So to me, it's, you know, that othering and the numbers game isn't something new, right? And I mean, if we look back to the 1960s, when the far right again was on the increase, and what was the response to that? The response of the state and of governments was, well, there is legitimate fears that people have about migration. We must bring in immigration acts. And we saw the 1962 Commonwealth Immigration Act, which the then leader of the Labour Party, Hugh Gaitskill, called cruel and brutal anti-colour legislation. And that opened the doors. In 1968, we had another Commonwealth Immigration Act, now to prevent Kenyan Asians, people who had British passports, from being able to enter the country. By 1971, we had a new Immigration Act, which was taking away the right of board in this country. So we've seen this, and the response to the narrative of the far right has been, they said there is some legitimacy in what the right have to say. The way to undercut them is to do two things. Is one, to take away the source of their concern, which is this legitimate concern about migration, so restrict migration. Second is to provide a more respectable outlet for their expression, and that's usually through constitutional politics. So, of course, we had the infamous example of Margaret Thatcher in the run-up to the 1979 general election legitimising that sentiment, saying that people were right to feel swamped by people of an alien culture, and trying to draw the far-right vote away from the National Front to mainstream politics. And it's been a story, of course, across Europe as well, that the progressive response to the far-right has been to play the race card, to mimic them. And then the problem is, once you begin that accepting that frame, then we're only quibbling about the numbers, right? Then it's a numbers game. And how many and where do you stand? And I think for progressive movements, the big question of what the left or progressive movements are saying about migration clearly is something that needs to be better. We need to have a better analysis and story about what we want to tell. Because I think it's hard to square an empty slogan that says, refugees welcome, migrants welcome, and then at the same time not recognising that actually Britain and Europe have got a policy of walls and fences. And how are we connecting those issues? And how are we providing and making people understand that actually the crisis that people are facing is not a crisis of migration? It's not that fact that there are people who are non-white Anglo-Saxons here. This is a crisis, an economic crisis. This is a crisis of political alienation. This is a number of other crises. And I think the far right, the big difference between the far right, I think, now and previously, is that they are much better at being able to tell the story, right? Mm-hmm. Our strategy, at least of previous decades, which was to prevent their propagation of their ideas by preventing them from holding meetings, from marching in the streets, preventing their physical activity, was really important because that was how you prevented them from expanding. When they're now able to do that online and in social media, it does become a battle of ideas. It does become much more important to have a much more robust opposition to them, because without it, their tide is growing stronger and stronger.
I think related to that, there's a growing problem on the British left that is essentially related to the myth of the white working class. And this sense of the white working class as, even if it's not spoken about in those terms, you know, you start talking about the fact that Brexit was built on racism, and essentially you get told, you're telling all Leave voters that they're racists. You start campaigning around free movement, and you start having a critique of Brexit, and you're accused of telling all Leave voters that they're racists. And there's no room in that conception of the world to start contradicting people. You know, this idea that we've got to be able to tell people that they are wrong. I don't think that there's an alternative vision, an alternative narrative about immigration that has been properly mainstreamed into the left and into the Labour Party just yet. And I think we've got to fight for that, because I think at the moment there is this attempt to essentially to rehabilitate the Brexit moment and to try to sort of change the frame on it. But going along with that is this deeply problematic sense that we can't tell people that they were wrong. And if we're ever going to change people's hearts and minds on immigration, you know, we're supposed to be the left with a Labour movement. If we can't go in and have arguments with working class people and tell them that they are wrong about immigration and wrong about questions of race, what are we for?
I think there's another thing that's related to this that worries me about the lack of alternative narrative around migration that, as I mentioned, because an alternative narrative that's both emotional and convincing and can provide any tangible long-term or mid-term or short-term solutions is inherently internationalist. There is no vision that Britain alone can provide that will solve the issues of migration or will even hold the tide of these waves of migration that people see, they identify. They might not think this is because of climate change or this is because of international conflicts that we're funding, but they see this global movement of people. And even now, here on the left, we are not prepared to go back to people and say, the only way we can deal with this is in collaboration with other people. Like, this is so much more than a national question. And in my experience, the British left lacks actual meaningful internationalism.
I would absolutely agree with you, the importance of internationalism. Look, when we look at the bigger picture of global migration, and then we look at the bigger picture of the rise of the global far right. And of course, what we're seeing is an inevitable consequence of decades of neoliberalism, of climate impacts, of growing inequality, of people wanting the right to a dignified life everywhere in the world, right? And being forced to move, and overwhelmingly being forced to move to inside their own countries or to other poor countries, right? The idea that people are moving in large numbers to the global north is absolutely incorrect. But the problem has been those ideas have been allowed to become what I would call accepted because they've been propagated by politicians, both of what we would traditionally call the left or the right. In terms of, if you think about New Labour and the war on asylum seekers, the idea that you could start to then talk again about deserving and undeserving, the migrants and the asylum seekers, cutting people out of welfare provision, throwing a bone to what I would call popular racism by saying we're tough on immigration, we're tough on migration, we're tough on all those. Now, the problem is that once you begin to normalise that, there's an inevitability about it. Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marie Le Pen's father, you know, very famously in the 1980s, you know, said when François Mitterrand and the socialist government in France started veering to the right on migration, and he said, oh, this is great because they can take our clothes, but there will come a time when people will say, will come back to the people who really believe it and really say it. And that's, I think, absolutely true. You know, if we start to understand how the far right have gone from being on the fringes of politics to the mainstream, and even when they're not in power, to actually be powerful in the sense it's their frame that begin to frame all politics, and so where the centre and the centre-left also begin to respond to that, partly as, well, we must stop the far right from entering, you know, usually we must stop the far right from entering Parliament. How best to do that? Let's mimic them so that there's no need to vote for the far right. I'm interested in not stopping simply the far right from being in Parliament, but actually tackling the ideas of the far right and actually talking about how we build both an anti-racist society in this country and globally. Because if we don't, the acceptance that people have about sacrificing people in the rest of the world will continue. And as long as we continue to do that, we're never going to be able to create the world that is going to be fairer and more equal. Because at this moment, the big questions, the crisis that the planet and people face require us to be international. It requires justice. It requires solidarity. Fundamental principles which are eroded by the far right's narrative around migration. So I know some people think, well, you know, we've got these other bigger fights and migration is simply one part of that fight. And I totally understand the legitimacy of people trying to understand how do we win and fight on all of these different fronts. But I think, you know, if the left forgets its values of anti-racism, there is a real problem. And this, again, I think there's lessons to be learned from the 1980s, when many of us said, what we need is anti-racism. We need an anti-racist society. And many people said, well, no, what we should have is a multicultural society. A multiculturalism, we should simply, we'll close the doors to everybody else, and then everybody else will be accepting of each other, and then that will be it. And then slowly over time, we'll integrate. You know, as long as you love our samosas and our steel bands and saris, you'll love us. Well, actually, no, you love our steel bands and saris and samosas, but you still hate us, you know. So unless you get to why that, and that is, of course, an historical issue. It's about the legacy of hundreds of years of colonialism and racism that underpin from slavery to colonialism and imperialism, and underpins actually the lack of action on the bigger global economic and social issues. So I see, you know, the question of migration has been a very central one. Now, there are different tactical conversations, and I think that's for a different moment about how you oppose physically the far right at the moment on the street. And I accept the right of all groups to come with their own frames and in terms of mobilising their own people. That's absolutely correct. But this has got to be part of a much bigger debate also amongst the anti-fascist and anti-racist movements about how and what principles are we simply defeating. Because it answers the question, what does victory look like? You know, if victory is simply that the Tommy Robinson and the EDL or the Football Lads Alliance are not marching on the streets, that's one part of that victory. But it's not the victory if mainstream politicians continue to parrot what the far right is saying about migration, etc., and all of those things. Then I see that as being a defeat. So I think it does go back to actually the no platform idea, right? You have to, yes, disrupt them physically, but it's also important to take on them ideologically and politically as well. And the ideological means that we have to understand how as Islamophobia become normalised? How is it being acceptable now in terms of mainstream politics? Where are the roots of that? And we can go back to talking about the war on terror. But if you go back before then about the frames that were used about the barbarian Muslims, the threat to Western civilization, etc., that has largely been accepted, right? The clash of civilizations and the framing. This isn't something new. You look back how people talked about Colonel Gaddafi, right, of Libya. Despot. But they talked about him as, you know, mad Gaddafi, you know, the mad Ayatollahs. And, the idea of the Muslim was we were violent, we were barbaric, we were backward. And look at now the narratives of what the far right are arguing online. It's saying, I'm no Islam is a barbaric, it's a backward, it's a, I'm not against the individual, I'm against this religion.
I think there's two big themes of this discussion that I just want to draw out as a way of provoking other kind of strategic thoughts. So the first theme, it seems to me, is the blurring of the distinction between racism and fascism is a really important part of what we're encountering now. And it links to this whole network politics that stretches from Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, Donald Trump, Aaron Banks, maybe Vladimir Putin via him, allegedly. There's this network of connections that have cultivated, often for very different reasons. I mean, Rees-Mogg, because he just wants to get out of the EU and he's a 19th century isolationist. Tommy Robinson, because he's a massive racist. But there's this sort of blurred relationship now. And that makes it very hard for us to say, well, these people are the fascists and these people are just in quote marks, being racist. Really difficult. I suppose the positive end of that point is that that's also an opportunity. Because the strategic problems that Assad was describing of the way, and I remember this, I mean, in the days of Unite Against Fascism, for example, I mean, it was really hard to get Unite Against Fascism to make anti-racist arguments in relation to, at the time, the new Labour government policy, or in relation at the time to what Rupert Murdoch's newspapers were printing every day about immigrants. You know, it was really tough because they said, we're just against the BNP and that's it. And that strategic position is pretty untenable now. I think everyone recognises that. And the second thing I wanted to raise comes back to something that Assad also said earlier in this conversation, but I think is really important. We need to draw out a bit because, you know, in the 1970s, you just like closed down the fascists. You physically confronted them when they were organising in the public space, in communities and attacking communities and so on. And you pushed away their ideas, you delegitimised them. Now, Tommy Robinson has a huge platform online through the internet. And it's really hard to undermine that platform, even when he's not in the mass media. I mean, you can say the BBC shouldn't put him up or interview him. And to be honest, they don't interview him that often. But even regardless, that's not how he got his 1 million Facebook followers. He got his 1 million Facebook followers through like startup, low-cost videos outside courts attacking Muslims. You know, that's where he gets his influence and profile. And then I suppose if I was being optimistic before, I mean, the pessimistic side is that there's just loads of data that shows Robinson's ideas have a massive base in Britain. And it's not just Britain, it's other European countries too. I mean, one stat produced by some academics, and David Runciman and others, in a recent project showed that 31% of Leave voters, so nearly a third of Leave voters, so you're looking at nearly 6 million people in Britain, believe that Muslim immigration into the UK is a conspiracy to create a majority Muslim population. I mean, that's just astounding. And what's interesting about that is that I think that position doesn't have much cultural legitimacy in Britain. I mean, it's an extreme position, but you're still talking about a social base for it of millions of people. Are we really arguing for less platform rather than no platform now, would be my provocative question.
I think everyone's a bit dumbstruck by thinking through that. I was having a conversation on the street stall with a woman in the East End in Poplar last week. And what was interesting was she wasn't even a Leave voter. She was a Remain voter. She voted Remain in the referendum and she still held some incredibly questionable ideas, and we started unpicking those. And in the end, she was basically saying that she doesn't have personal problems with any of her neighbours. She has no issues with the Muslim people around her. What she wants is for white people to be the majority in her neighborhood. She doesn't care what jobs they have, what people contribute, what kind of an environment she lives in. We talked for a really long time. We talked about housing. We talked about infrastructure. You know, all these good things that, for example, if someone is doing training for canvassing with the Labour Party these days, will tell you to direct the conversation to.
I have to say, I love the idea of you having this long, patient, careful conversation about housing policy, and at the end of it someone just says, oh look, I'm really sympathetic to a lot of what you say, but I'm just a straight up honest racist.
Yeah, but that's not even what she says, right? She says, well, basically I don't mind my neighbors, they're fine, they're polite, you know, they tidy after themselves and everything, but look at this area, look at it. And I was like, well, it's a lively market, what is wrong with this area? And she said, well, I'm white and you're white and everyone else isn't. And that's just the level at which we're still thinking about some of these things. And I think what Asad was saying earlier is really important, because at the point where we started talking about multiculturalism, well, basically what we were saying was there will be spaces for people, and people of different groups and different communities can occupy different spaces, and we don't care how they interact and to what extent they interact, and we don't care about challenging the negative perceptions they have of each other, as long as we can keep them relatively contained and not causing trouble for each other as much. Like, that's the level of anti-racism, really, that has been happening over the past 30 or 40 years, I think. And now that is cracking, that's just disintegrating under our feet, partly because of the internet, I think, because people no longer are contained in those little circles and only talking about their concerns with their families. They're talking about their concerns with other people all over the country.
I wanted to come back to this sort of linking on from the internet element that Elena highlighted about the sort of no platform, less platform issue that Luke highlighted. I think on the one hand, I still believe in the principles of no platform, and I think it would be profoundly dangerous if we got into the idea of watering down those principles simply because, you know, Twitter exists. But on a slightly deeper level, no platform has always been about less platform. You know, no platform properly conceived for me is not some bureaucratic lever that you pull where you legislate that your, say, your student union or your trade union does not go on a platform or will not give a room to this person, and that's a thing that you can have as a policy that's written down. No platform is a whole spirit of how you organise. So as well as denying fascist rooms and not sharing platforms with them, it's an attempt to disrupt, to actively disrupt everything they do. You know, the act of not sharing a platform with Nick Griffin is the same as the act, for me, as when you see a fascist stall in the street and no one is manning it and it's safe to do so, kicking it over and stealing all their contact sheets. This is about a tactic to actively fight their ability to organise and to attack them. But I do think that there's another broader definitional point and a strategic problem for the left and the anti-fascist left here. When we talk about these sort of blurring of these lines through the Jacob Rees-Mogg's and the right wing of the Conservative Party and the Trumps and then Farages and through to the Yaxley Lennons and the, or Robinson, however we want to call him. And I suppose really, to some extent, for many people, the difference between Yaxley Lennon is just the fact that he is mobilising on the streets and that is his main thing. But what we're about to see on December the 9th, and we'll see how well it comes off, is the birth of UKIP into that zone. It's the birth of UKIP into that area and a sort of street mobilisation. I think that's going to provide some interesting problems. I finally just wanted to touch on, sort of connected to that, when we talk about UAF and how, you know, Luke was saying it was very difficult to get people to talk about, you know, racist politics of the New Labour government, etc. And that was built around this strategic idea that what we would have is a narrow politics and a big turnout. And that was our main thing. We want the narrowest possible politics on fascism and therefore as many people on the streets as possible. That our job as an anti-fascist movement was to meet the fascists and the fascism exists as a street movement, primarily, and our job as anti-fascists is simply to turn out as many people onto the streets as the same on the same day as that fascist movement. And if you try to do anything else, if you try to do anything sort of more tactically radical, if you try to raise additional slogans, if you try to talk about racism in a more detailed way, you know, the leadership of the anti-fascist movement as it was would say, no, there's a leadership of this anti-fascist movement, the leadership is us, and by raising your additional slogans, by fighting for a narrower politics, but for a politics that has less appeal, because it says more things and tells some people that they're wrong about some things, you are being divisive, and your attempt to introduce your politics into this protest is splitting the anti-fascist movement. And I suppose what I see in a way in the latest episode, where another Europe has called an anti-Brexit pro-free movement block on a united anti-fascist protest, is an exact echo of that idea. What's interesting about that sort of cacophony of sort of outrage that we've had the temerity to organise our own anti-fascist mobilisation block on a united anti-fascist mobilisation is that it's coming from a lot of people who absolutely reject the stand up to racism and UAF way of doing things, and yet in some sense this idea that by raising more politics you're being divisive is and splitting the movement is absolutely there in some of their reactions to what we've done.
I'm not from another Europe, is possible, and I've from the sidelines, of course, have seen that it sparked a huge debate on parts of the left about how do we organise and what is the framing in which we organise, and I think actually that's needed, right? I mean, we do actually need a real discussion and a debate. It should be done from a starting point that says, you know, we have a collective vision, which is to defeat the far right. We have a collective vision to be anti-racist, and we know some of the key battlegrounds on which the far right are organising. Now, there can be tactical differences about what frame should you use. Should you talk about Brexit or leave in that? Should you talk more about freedom of movement? Should you talk about Fortress Britain? All of those things. I think those are very, 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 very legitimate. And, you know, I think one of the failures has been the fact that we've not been able to have a much more honest conversation about our own inabilities to be able to put forward a real alternative to the far right's and to the populist rights narrative. And I suppose, Lena makes the point about this, about the woman she was talking to, and it speaks a lot to what you see now, right, of what we talk about, this new populist right. It's not a fascist movement in its classic sense, right? They are managing to build a right-wing, extreme right-wing populist movement, of which the fascists are one part, right? But its breadth is much, much bigger. And we have to understand what are the frames that connect that populist element. The people who say, I'm not a fascist, I'm not a Nazi, but I agree with what Tommy Robinson's saying. Or I do think that there are issues about X, Y, and Z and how they're creating their big tent and who's in the tent and what unifies. And we know that white identity or nativism has become such a central part of the story of this new right. So you look at the Italian, what was the Northern League is now the League, or you look at Austria, you look at not just Le Pen in France. The thing that connects them and connects also with Trump across in the Atlantic is this idea of white identity and of nativism. And it has always been there, of course, and that we can talk about it, and there's lots of new phrases and terms, and we say it's white supremacy, it's an integral part of Western society, and that's how we've managed to legitimise so many horrible things happening through history. And it's simply the expression of that as that becomes to be challenged increasingly by women of colour, women, feminist movements, the plurality of our progressive movements challenges that. Their response to that is white identity. And it, with its throwbacks to a green and pleasant land which had no black people in it and everything was lovely, forgetting that actually in that green and pleasant land that the majority of ordinary people were the at the bottom of the pile. And it wasn't a green and pleasant. In fact, it was a dirty, dirty experience for most ordinary people, right? A shitty life experience of oppression and exploitation. But what they've added to it, and I think this is really important for us to... is their ability to be able to grasp and exploit technology. So they're organising to be able to organise online much better and faster than we've ever been, I think. I mean, the progressive movements pride themselves on our ability to be, well, we dominate on social media and aren't we really, really great? But actually, I would ask, and I think there's a genuine question, are we only mobilising in our own echo chamber? And is the far right able to actually penetrate parts of society where the left have not been able to? And we could say there's a lot of reasons for that. The infrastructure of society or progressive infrastructure is hollowed out, whether it's trade unions or churches or tenants associations, community organisations, places that were there for communities that allowed an expression and brought people together. They're all disappeared. So when you're angry and you're alienated, how do you express that? Well, now you've got it in your phone. You've got this thing in your phone and you're able to. And how are the right, you know, reinforcing these particular frames, etc. And then I think we've also got to say that the far right, never in its history, has had the amount, at least in from the 70s onward, has this amount of money. And the role of the money coming in from the from US foundations, from extreme right wing shadowy foundations, from people like the Middle East Forum and the other Freedom Centre who are handing Tommy Robinson huge amounts of money. This is not some shoestring outfits now that are operating. And this is where we have to understand the Bannon network as well as the far right network. One thing for the anti-racist, anti-fascist left of the 80s was that if you put the far right of Europe together, they would all end up fighting each other, right? So you could never put... a lot of the fascists hated each other. But actually now you see much more cooperation and you're seeing these echoes of these three things. White identity, Islamophobia, migration, and, of course, the exploitation of neoliberalism and austerity. So our left... or progressive response to that has got to be, of course, providing an economic alternative. But actually, it's also got to be to go out and win arguments with people in communities, in areas, and start to win progressive ideas. It's not simply if we rally the faithful to protest on the 9th and then we share some memes amongst just progressive people and everybody validates that by Facebook likes or tweets and that, and we think, isn't that really great? We've really dented their ideas. Actually, no, we've not dented their ideas. Their ideas are propagating to us a part of British society that we are not able to get to. And that's why the no platform of Tommy Robinson, at least in terms of on the mainstream media, has been an issue. Because you want to say, because some people say, well, it's just a battlefield of ideas and you can go up there and blah, 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 and we'll expose him. No, you also normalise him. And because we're not challenging the ideas on the ground, it simply normalises. And of course, as a black person, I would say, the problem is when they normalise that and play the race card, we play for it with blood on the streets. And that's the consequence. If you look at the steep rise in racist attacks that we've seen, you know, the Islamophobia attacks, increase of 40%. If you see the attacks, I mean, people have been shocked by this video recently of the Syrian refugee and his the young boy and his sister being attacked at that school. And, you know, to me, it just brought back memories. That was my everyday experience going through school in the 70s and 80s. That's what that normalisation of that racism is beginning to do. It's permeated down there. So then the issue is, how are we fighting in our schools, in our communities, in our tenants' associations, and rebuilding all that? So part, of course, the answer is, yes, we have to talk about housing. Yes, we have to talk about employment. We have to talk about... But we also have to take on the racist ideas. If you don't, you know, the far right can match us by saying, yes, we also agree with you about globalisation, about neoliberalism, about alienation. We agree with you that the working class has been forgotten. Of course, in their version of the working class, we somehow don't exist. And that's why I'm so angry when people say, you know, we have to justify this because this is some the working class has said. No, the working classes don't say we're working class as well. That's not what we say. And actually, there's large parts of the white working class communities that are deeply anti-racist and have been deeply anti-fascist. And to say that somehow this is this whole homogeneous block of people out there, and we have to recognise there's some legitimacy with that, and so we have to temper our anti-racism in some way of that. No, absolutely not. We have to win the battle of ideas, and it's really, really important that what happens on December 9th and what happens on December 11th isn't the end, you know, because actually whatever happens with regards to Britain, it's staying inside the European Union, outside of the European, whatever the deal is, the far right will use that to build. And our challenge is, how are we building a movement that can take them on, again, politically, ideologically and physically? And I totally agree with you, Michael. It's not simply the idea that there's some formal, that we're asking some institution to simply prevent somebody from being speak. The idea was always that it's a way of us engaging people about why you need to know platform people, of winning and organising. And at the centre of all anti-racism is organising. I've come on here partly to stand with you all during this difficult moment, because I think it's nuts, right? It's nuts. Whatever you... No, but I mean, look, I have... You know, we can have political discussion about the tactically what you do, but so you're in an organisation, you have absolutely every right to bring your fucking banner and mobilise your own bloc. I can't understand why the left is losing its shit about that, rather than actually what it should be losing its shit about is how are we fucking losing to the far right, right?
How are we giving up on, huge immigration debate?
I know.
Diane Abbott mentioning hiring more border guards four times in her conference speech.
I know. It's two different debates, right? So there's a genuine debate that we need to have, which is, how do you beat the new far right? How do we understand it? What is its themes? What is it European-wide? Blah, blah, blah. Then there's a second one, which is, what is the tactical conversation about the 9th of December and the 11th of December? And that I think it's not necessarily helpful that we merge them all in one. Yes, they are played out on the 9th and 11th, but actually we don't, you know, the ideas what we have are, they stand alone, right? They're irrespective of the 9th and 11th, right? Yeah. They, no matter what are their outcomes, whatever outcome, if you have a second people's vote, you win a people's vote, whatever, I think the right will grow. It's not going to go away. If they win and we leave, the right is going to... Yeah, if we confuse a tactical fight, part of the problem is that the other side if we're being honest and we say that we think that their frame or their understanding of racism could do with more depth, they're already going to be turned off, right? Because they're going to say, this is all about a tactical fight. This is an inter-left fight between another Europe is possible and the Lexiteers on one side, or another Europe is possible and Corbynistas, right, and Navarra Media, as if it's about individuals and personalities and groupings and where you stand in the Corbyn project. And that's what might... Yeah, I know we are, but to me that's the most ridiculous starting point. I'm not interested in whether you're bloody a fucking a Corbynista or not a Corbynista. I'm interested in how are we building an anti-racist movement, right? And what are the debates that we have? Because it's no good being a Corbynista and it's part of being a Corbynista, the test being don't say anything about tricky subjects about migration or racism or internationalism, right? That's a bigger debate. What is a Corbynista, right? But I just don't want... I think that confusing the tactical fight with the actual deeper debate is a mistake, right? Because this tactical one, it's a blip for a moment, right?
I think they're angry in the moment, but I think I think it's worth... I think there's that anger and that vitriol is worth examining to see what's underneath it. Because I think... I'm not implying...
Maybe people just personally don't like you, Michael.
I mean, that's true of a remarkable number of people.
I would say it's partly because people are going to get very... are threatened and feel very, very jealous, right? You've... Ultimately, it looks like you're going to win what another Europe is possible wanted to do, right? Its goal is going to be probably the likely outcome of Labour's position, right? Calling for a people's vote, right? I think that's generated a lot of people saying, how the fuck have this tiny bunch of things that we thought were insignificant managed to do this?
So thanks to you at home for listening, and I hope you join the protests against the far right in whatever way you can, whether that's coming to the demonstration in London on the 9th of December or sharing content exposing their lies on your social media. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it, and better still, leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can also feed back to us on Twitter on @another_Europe or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. We'll be back in 2 weeks. See you then.